wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, Portland's only community democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement is our engineer. The Old Mole is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, politics, and current events than that of the corporate-owned conventional news media. Today on our program, Bill Resnick will be talking with Gwen Sullivan, who's the president of the Portland Association of Teachers, and Elizabeth Teal, an activist teacher. This is the first part of a two-part interview that discusses the teachers' contract struggle with the Portland School District and how the teachers are planning to follow up after winning a contract that put them in a position to build more engaging schools and curriculum. Joe Clement talks with Karen Carr about something called the Portland Free Store. Is that to be taken literally? Our Left in the Law team, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, will be discussing the recent California court decision that found the state's death penalty to be unconstitutional. And concluding our program today, Jan Hawken returns talking with Carla Castaneda and Perla Alvarez with Momentum Alliance, an organization that runs a summer camp called We Are Brave for Underrepresented Youth. Now here's Bill.
Gwen Sullivan and Elizabeth Teal, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Gwen Sullivan is president of the Portland Association of Teachers. Elizabeth Teal is a teacher at Madison High School. She's the union rep for Madison High School, and she's on the legislative assessment committee of the PAT. Both Elizabeth and Gwen were part of the leadership group that inspired their fellow teachers, who mobilized in nearly every school. They reached out to the community. They showed great determination and patience in making the teachers' case, often to a hostile media, but a much less hostile, in fact, friendly community. And they led the way to winning a wonderful contract. The contract only had a small raise in wages, that after several years of wage reductions. But what was so strikingly wonderful about the contract was that it put the teachers in position to create far more involving, stimulating lessons and courses in schools with smaller class sizes. We'll get to that later, how they intend to build truly wonderful schools. First, Gwen and Elizabeth, in retrospect, why do you think you were so successful in winning what was a really sensationally good contract?
I think there's a lot of reasons, but to me, the most striking reason why we were successful is really that we were united with teachers and with parents and the community and what we were fighting for, which was better schools for our kids. It was just really clear to teachers and families that schools have been cut enough and we needed to start building back. And that was the core of our message.
Yeah, I would say that Elizabeth's correct. It is exactly, it's a variety of different things, but the fact that we were determined to make our schools better, and it's not over, we still are, and our parents, our students, and the community, they're with us. They'd like to work with us, not against us.
Tell us a little bit about how you organized. The teachers really got organized and were talking to people and showed that they were united and would strike if necessary. How did you manage to mobilize so many people who were probably very afraid of striking?
I think that what was a little simpler than we thought was when you create a vision for what you want schools to be, that people get on board and they believe in it too. I think that one, knowing that we wanted to have smaller class sizes so we could actually individualize our instruction for students, that means something. That we wanted to make sure that our kids had more offerings, that they all had the opportunities for music, for dance, for drama, for art, for PE, that those are things that are important to our parents and our students and our teachers. And so I think that specifically that creating a vision made it a little easier to organize our own folks first and then the community at large.
And you built just the mechanics of it. You built the union rep system up. You did the 1-for-10
Yes.
system.
Yeah, so this was really an opportunity to exercise our organizing muscles. Buildings can have one union representative for every 10 members. And so that's not always been something that's been actively in place, but there was reason to really make sure every building was organized. So I know I work at a large site with 80 teachers. So we had 8 union reps going out probably weekly to talk one-on-one with members to make sure teachers were well-informed of what was going on and how to get involved. I think another thing that was at play is really it was very clear to teachers that enough is enough, and it was time to stand up. Teachers are so busy. Most teachers do not want to spend their evenings and weekends going to meetings and rallies because they want to be doing the work of a teacher, which they're already doing full-time plus a whole lot more. So I think it really speaks to the passion that our teachers have, that they were willing to be coming to rallies, to be coming to meetings, to be talking to neighbors. It's a huge amount of time and effort that teachers really put into fighting for the schools that our students deserve, because people felt it so deep down how important it was.
We were talking earlier. Elizabeth said part of the reason that you won was that the school district and their lawyers were so clumsy. And the contract that they offered was so, they were trying to crush you.
Yeah. Well, my feeling was that the district really miscalculated where the community would be falling in this issue. They seemed to be putting out messages assuming that the community would get on their side when they talked about crushing teachers and taking away rights. And I feel like that really backfired on them. When messaging went out about how they wanted to strengthen management rights, the community, parents, and people who support public education came out very loudly on the side of teachers, saying they don't want teachers to lose rights. They want teachers to have the right to use their professionalism and do their job well. So I think the district really ended up putting themselves in a position where they seemed disconnected from our community because of the way they were talking about our teachers. And parents know that teachers work hard and need to have their rights so that they can do their job to the best of their ability.
I found the last couple of weeks amazing in the strike. And what was really amazing was the amazing support you got from parents. And then what was truly remarkable is when students began walking out, disciplined, spirited, thoughtful, that broke their back, actually. Tell us, how did you feel when that began happening?
So in the last 2 weeks, approximately 2 weeks before we were to go on strike, it was pretty inspiring to look back at that time, because what was happening, there was a rolling amount of support with different groups. And with the students, they completely understand, because we work with them every day, they completely understand that their learning environment is our working environment. And so to hear them say, if the teachers strike, we strike too, was very empowering. I would also say the faith community, the faith leaders in Portland coming out with a letter saying, we support the teachers. If the district forces them to strike, we will open up our doors and bring in the kids so they have a safe place to go. That was inspiring. We had parents that were organizing their own rallies. We had community members that were going school to school and handing out flyers. And then our own teachers over and over were going into school board meetings, meeting with different organizations and neighborhood groups. It was definitely inspiring, and there was definitely a movement that was growing.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. I'm Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Gwen Sullivan and Elizabeth Teal of the Portland Association of Teachers. They won a great contract. We talked about how they succeeded. We just talked about how they succeeded. And a good part of that success ultimately was the support of parents and students. Gwen and Elizabeth, my sense was that I did leaflet the Harrison Park School out in Southeast, off Division, met a lot of parents in the parking lot, and got the sense that parents and students really liked the schools and liked the teachers and wanted to talk about that and didn't want the strike happen. The reason I think the parents were so supportive, because over the years, parents had come to really like teachers and appreciate teachers and appreciate how hardworking they were and how they supported their kids and how the teachers even bought materials for their classes.
I think it's important to know that in Portland, we are very fortunate that 86% of the population of people that have kids send their kids to public school. And that is in all socioeconomic classes, they're still sending their kids to public schools. That's actually unheard of in a lot of urban areas. So one, that just means that they support teachers and they recognize that teachers go well over and beyond their call of duty to work with their kids. And they recognize that they're under some really intense pressure to try to do their work, even with their class sizes being and caseloads being huge and all of the different requirements.
This is KBOO Radio 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Gwen Sullivan and Elizabeth Teal of the Portland Association of Teachers about their recent fight for what turned out to be a wonderful contract. We just discussed why they won such a good contract in their recent contract struggle. Gwen and Elizabeth, teachers across the country are in struggle to save public education from the corporatizers and the privatizers. And it's becoming clear that the corporatizers are, to say the least, very influential with the rest of the business community, also with politicians and the media. But on the other hand, teachers have daily contact with children, and especially in the elementary and middle schools with many, maybe most parents, who nearly everywhere like the teachers and think they are doing a good job. But every era, and it seems to me in Portland too, it's ever harder to really teach to maintain schools that the students and parents really like. Let's talk soon about how Portland teachers intend to maintain and enhance school quality and why the contract enables them to do that. First, though, even Portland schools have tried to satisfy the privatizers. There's lots of changes over the last several years that have really injured the schools and teaching, you know, actually degraded schools and made it harder to really teach.
So one thing that's a really clear change, I've been teaching for 10 years, which is coincidentally the exact length of No Child Left Behind legislation, which increased the amount of standardized testing. In those 10 years, I've seen a steady increase in the amount of time that we're taking away from teaching kids and an increase in the amount of time we're using to assess kids and more frequently with tests that don't inform teachers, especially in the grades 3 through 8, where kids are testing and reading and math often 3 times a year or more to take tests to predict how they'll do on the state test. And the reason isn't because teachers think these tests are helpful. And it's often not even because principals think these tests will be helpful, but because the corporate education reform has put so much at stake that schools are in a panic to increase test scores so that they don't lose funding, and that's happening at the expense of so many other things. There's been a lot of talk about increasing instructional hours in high schools and increasing the length of the school year in PPS. At the same time, we're increasing the amount of time where we're not instructing within that school year to increase the amount of time we're testing in the school year. So that's been a huge thing. And teachers don't have control over what happens in those blocks of time that are set for mandated assessments.
Yeah. 3 times a year doesn't seem like much, but you know, three afternoons a year, is that so bad? But it isn't that. These tests go on for quite a while. And then there's the teaching how to take tests. You're doing instructing. A lot of teachers do a lot of instruction. And some of the instruction is how to answer a bubble test. How do you get better at figuring out what these Machiavellian people who design these tests want to hear and knowing the cliches that get you through life?
Mm-hmm. So what I think is important to know, if we take a step back and you look at the people that are pushing this, that this is all about test scores, because it's the only measurement that they can truly understand of what success is. And children are not widgets. These tests are all addressed in the same manner. It's not about creativity. It's not about problem solving. It's not about collaboration and working together. It is really about, can they think in one direction rather than can they think broad? And I think that one of the things that's really important to us and our parents, and they understand this, is even though we have all of this pressure from this corporate agenda to privatize our schools, I think it's important to know that we can easily teach to a test. That's not hard. What's hard is to actually educate children and all children to make sure that they reach their full potential. So our pushback is over and over about we don't want to teach to the test, and our parents and students don't want us to either. So I think that's a big part of it.
Yeah. And
It also creates great anxiety in the kids, right? And
huge.
The teachers, it seems to me, they approach these tests as do the kids in Southeast Asia. My whole future depends on
yes.
this. My parents want me to do well. I mean, there's a lot of kids, it seems to me, who really get terrified.
Yeah. I mean, the tests are designed to create anxiety for teachers and schools and kids because the message behind the test is something bad will happen if your numbers aren't good enough. That's the message at every level. I think what's...
To you personally and to the schools.
Absolutely, yeah. Yes. And one thing that I have really been struck by as a teacher and as a parent, my kids go to public schools in Portland, is how much teachers do to hold that off of kids' backs. And I've really seen, I think it's a form of resistance with teachers really fighting to have joy in their classrooms and fighting to minimize how these tests impact kids. And it's inspiring and humbling to see teachers who are given, you know, kind of one clear set of instructions. Your job is to get kids to pass these tests and finding ways to still make their classrooms the joyful, creative places that they envision. Because the truth is, I've never met a teacher that came into teaching because they wanted to get kids to take tests really well, although it's, you know, nice if they do. But teachers come into teaching because they want to make kids' lives better. And I see teachers staying really true to that, despite all of this pressure to really make it about numbers.
That's my sense, too, from the teachers that I've met. Higher class sizes make it much harder. And the corporatizers are not only forcing canned curriculum and tests on you, they are starving the schools of money and trying to get them to hire more administrators and more supervisors. And class sizes have really risen in the Portland schools as well. It seems to me it makes it much, much harder.
Mm-hmm.
And much harder even to assign writing. Grading 40 papers is really much more work, hours and hours a week more work than grading 20.
You know, you talk about a class size of or having to grade 40 papers. I think a lot of our teachers at the high schools and middle schools would actually welcome having to grade 40 papers because they often have to grade anywhere from 120 to 180. That's what their class or their student load sizes are. And virtually impossible to give honest feedback on all of those type of writing assignments. So you're right. It is hard to make sure to do that, but they have to figure out different ways, creative ways on how to give feedback. They often spend, you know, weekends and evenings grading papers, giving feedback to make sure that their students understand how to change their own practice of writing.
Can you talk about the impact of higher class sizes?
I think at the elementary school, higher class sizes are... The fact is that in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, these are the beginning years when kids learn how to read. And if you have class sizes that are so large, kids are at different places. They're like popcorn. They pop at different times. And if you miss that, then because your class sizes are so big, you've missed an opportunity for a kid. So then when do they get that individual attention to figure out what they're learning and how they're learning? Well, hopefully the next year. But by then, you still have large class sizes. So we have so many missed opportunities to work with our kids. And the idea of having to differentiate your instruction between kids that struggle and kids that excel and everything in between, kids with some severely special needs and behavior needs, in many aspects, it's almost impossible. But despite all of that, our teachers are dedicated to trying to make a difference.
Yeah. And I guess another way that I see that playing out when schools lose funding, it happens with higher class sizes. But the other thing that happens is loss of programming. 20 years ago, schools had kids in middle school and elementary school had art and music and PE and maybe home ec and shop and speech and drama. And now those things have been whittled away to such an extent that a lot of schools maybe have a half-time PE teacher. The elective they get might be counseling because there's not another elective teacher out there. Maybe there's a half-time art teacher, but a lot of schools don't have electives at all. And so I know at my kids' school, there is a PE teacher, but it's not enough. They get it once a week. So their classroom teacher teaches PE. And at a lot of schools, the classroom teachers are teaching the art and the music because they don't want the kids to miss out on it. but it's asking teachers to do way more than might have been expected of a teacher in the past when schools were adequately funded. And most teachers are doing whatever they can to give kids that full experience that they envision for kids. But I mean, it's an increase in the load of what a teacher is expected to plan for, and probably in the experience the kid gets, because we're not talking about, schools don't have art rooms in a lot of cases. They don't have materials. So again, teachers really try to soften that load on kids, and it's really admirable and noble. But the ultimate solution is to put the funding back so that kids can have the full program that parents envision their kids having when they go to school.
The love of learning often for many kids doesn't just come in English and math. It comes in music and dance and drama. If the kids have don't have those opportunities, then that tells you that the kid doesn't have an opportunity to have the love of learning.
Yeah. When I was in school back a long time ago, we had wood shop and metal shop and art shop, and there were people there after school helping us measure and make toys. I made toys for my younger siblings and other things as well. It made learning to be fun, because you had it, and there was a reason for learning.
Right, yeah.
I would learn math, and then I could work on things. A lot of that is gone, I'm afraid.
Yes. And it's interesting at schools, too, with all the pressure for testing. One choice that's often made at schools now is to have a position to be a testing specialist. So instead of having an art teacher, a school might choose instead to have a testing
coordinator
who spends the whole day doing testing.
Oh, how horrible.
Absolutely. But I think one of the things that's also important is you talk about, you know, where you're learning math and then after school you go in and you're making toys, or that shop class. Those are the things that we're trying to get back, that we're trying to make sure that we have more of an application of, to see both sides, that these programs that are considered extras aren't, they're integrated into the work that we do every day.
And then there's one final thing. You used to have school counselors. Kids are all troubled. They're trying to build personalities. They're trying to deal with all their problems. Growing up is both glorious and painful. And kids need people to talk to, people who can really talk to them at length about their dilemmas. There are just fewer of them, right? I mean, now counselors in high schools mostly are talking about how do you get into college, right? And what should you apply for? But real long-term help where you can talk to kids and form relationships, it seems to me there's just less of them.
There are so few counselors, and there are so many more kids with serious emotional needs. And I will say that, again, when Oregon moved over, the 50% are now in that free and reduced lunch. It just happened. We have so much more poverty, and that is a direct correlation with we have so many more emotionally need kids. At the same time, they are cutting those programs. And so our push is to make sure that we have counselors, more counselors in our schools, not less, more mental health providers in our schools, not less, that we have wraparound services and some of those mental health providers that can actually go into our students' homes and work with their families. That's what we need. The fact is that schools often will provide the safety net for our families, and at the same time they're pulling all these funds away.
Right. And one very admirable goal that PPS has right now is to reduce the number of out-of-school suspensions, which absolutely we want kids in school and in class. In order to reduce discipline problems in schools, we need to increase the services that kids in crisis are getting.
Yes.
And if the district wants to decrease the amount of disciplinary actions, which I very much hope that they can, what we need to do is increase the amount of supports available to kids in a positive way, so that when they're in crisis, there's somewhere for them to go. Because that's another instance where when counselors get cut, when counselors aren't available, that means the classroom teacher is then also responsible to be the counselor. And in schools, especially where a large majority of kids are living in poverty, there's a lot of crisis that comes with that, that comes into the classroom. And counselors are so needed to help give kids the emotional support and sometimes emotional instruction that they need to be able to deal with those things and go on to be successful in school.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM. That was the first part of an interview with Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, and Elizabeth Teal, an activist teacher. The second part, to play next week, discusses how the teachers are planning to follow up their victory by building more engaging schools and curricula. What exactly is a free store? Joe Clement now talks with Karen Carr, who runs a store with that name.
I'm Joe Clement for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I am joined today by Karen Carr, an organizer of the Portland Free Store. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So the Portland Free Store has been around for how long, Karen?
Since December 2012, so a little more than a year and a half now.
And is it exactly what it sounds like, a place where you go to get free stuff?
It is. It's really extremely simple. It's just like a church rummage sale where people, a lot of families bring things they don't need anymore, outgrown clothes, toys that their children don't play with anymore, outgrown bicycles, and then we lay it all out on tables like a rummage sale, but then we just don't put prices on, so anybody can come and take home whatever they want, as much as they want.
In what other ways is it not quite like a church rummage sale?
Well, the original inspiration for it was from the way we were distributing things during the occupation down in Chapman Square, where we had tents distributing free food and free clothing and free toys and books and things. And when that closed after the eviction, we started to think about, well, we don't really need a park and an occupation in order to continue distributing free clothes and free everything. And so by the time a year after the occupation, we had gotten sufficiently organized to hold the first free store. And we wanted to do it right before the holidays so that we could give away gifts so people could do their Christmas shopping at the free store, which they did.
So how exactly is it operated and what's its relationship with the space?
We just ask people around town if we could use their space just for the afternoon for the free store. And I very seldom had anyone say no. People are usually delighted to have the free store come and give things away to their congregation or their school or whoever it is. We've done them at schools. We've done them at churches. We've done them at the East Side Swap and Play. So we've done them in public parks. We're open to pretty much any location that, you know, has enough space and doesn't need to charge for it.
So what kind of stuff do you guys carry or have you seen people bring and take?
We'll take anything that's small enough that I can lift it by myself. So we don't take couches and beds. But we give away, you know, often very nice things. There's all kinds of things people don't want. We give away bicycles, Xboxes, leather jackets. There's also a lot of old jeans and t-shirts and things that people don't want anymore. But we give away often very high quality things that people just don't want anymore. Rugs, shopping cart, you know, those grocery cart things that people pull, strollers. At the last free store, we gave away two gigantic dog houses, which did not fall in the category things I could lift by myself. But they turned up anyway. But fortunately, other people took them home.
Where is the next free store going to be?
The next one's coming right up. So next Saturday, July 26th, and it's at 16th and Alberta at the house that's community supported everything, 1626 Northeast Alberta Street from 1 to 3.
I understand you guys are trying to raise money to buy a truck. What would that enable you to do, you hope?
Well, like I said, we can't take anything that is too heavy for me to lift. And that's because we don't have a truck. And if we were raising money, we're hoping to get enough donations to buy a truck. We're about a third of the way there now. We have about $1,000 raised towards a truck. And I think with $3,000, we could actually go ahead and get a truck and insure it. And we'd like to be able to pick up people's couches and deliver them to somebody else's house that needs a couch, couches, beds, play structures, dog houses, all that kind of thing. Also, if we had a truck, we could establish a food bank. You know, we could deliver food boxes to people's houses because people often want to donate food to the free store. And, you know, but we don't have any way of distributing it at the moment. So for both of those reasons, largely so that we could recycle big things as well as small things, keep them out of the landfills, and help people out with furniture as well as with clothing. If you have $100 or even, you know, anything at all that you can donate towards the truck, you can find us on Facebook at PDX Free Store, or the website is quatras.us/freestorepdx.
So in what way is the Free Store not just a charity store like at the church?
Yeah, we're not at all a charity store. We don't think of ourselves that way at all. There's no needs test. People with plenty of money come and take things too. That's not why we're doing it. I mean, it's a happy side effect that a lot of people who can't afford things get things. But really, we have a more political purpose to try to show people that buying things, working for wages, those aren't the only ways that people in a society can exchange stuff, that you can give them to each other. And this is giving. The government can choose to distribute things, as with the public library, for example. You can form a collective with members who contribute to something, which is how KBOO operates and how the Free Store is hoping to begin operating as we begin to do some fundraising and move hopefully into having a truck and then eventually into having a permanent space and being able to be open every afternoon and not just once a month.
I really like how that takes kind of the idea of non-commercial to a more radical end.
Right. I mean, it's been pointed out that really most of the things that you do in a day are not commercial already. You cook lunch for your family. That's not a commercial transaction. You volunteer at the kids' school. Again, it's not a commercial transaction. You
give somebody directions who asks you on the sidewalk.
Right,
no one,
exactly.
No one's paying you for that.
You give someone a birthday present. You go to somebody's wedding. Nobody's paying you to do any of those things. A lot of the things we do are not commercial transactions. And historically, the commercial transaction as the basis for all human interaction is a relatively recent innovation.
We'll have to pick up that conversation online at kboo.fm/Old Mole Variety Hour. I've been talking with Karen Carr of the Portland Free Store, which will be having another event on July 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. at the Community Supported Everything Building, which is on Northeast Alberta at 1626. Thanks for joining us, Karen.
Thank you.
This is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. If you want to learn more about the Free Store, there will be an extended version of this interview on the webpage in a day or two, where they discuss the vision of expanding this Free Store and see it spread. Now, our Left in the Law team, Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker, are here to talk about a surprise decision by the U.S. District Court judge who declared the California death penalty to be unconstitutional.
Well, Mike, there's been quite a bit of discussion and some jubilee over this federal judge's decision last week, the ruling that the California death penalty is unconstitutional based on its arbitrariness and failure to deliver the guarantee of deterrence. I guess there's been more emphasis on this aspect of arbitrariness. Let's first talk about the ruling in a bit more detail and then its broader implication for the movement and the death penalty.
Well, it will have broader implications, in part because the judge is a solid conservative guy. He's not a radical San Francisco district court judge. He's a man who assembled on his own, without any attorneys helping him, a color graph of what's actually happened to 700 people who were sentenced to death in California. He looked at the class of people who were sentenced to death between 1977 and 1997 and discovered that more of them had committed suicide than had been executed. More still have died
while in prison.
While in prison, while on death row. That more people have died of old age. He showed that basically the system is wanton and freakish, in his words. It's akin to being struck by lightning. There's no rational way to explain who finally dies and who doesn't. He showed that in California, on your appeal, you'll wait 3 to 4 years, typically, before you even get a lawyer. And on your habeas petition, you're the equivalent of what in Oregon's called a post-conviction review, or PCR. People will never get a lawyer sometimes. They'll just languish waiting around even after their direct appeal's been affirmed, because nobody will take a case. The reasons are simple. The pay is mediocre, you always lose, and you will not be given enough money to do what the U.S. Constitution requires you to do.
And yet, much of the press about the death penalty is that it's enormously expensive. In fact, some of the shift in support for the death penalty is based on this very claim that it costs a lot of money to keep people incarcerated on death row and to provide the appeals that are necessary. But you're saying now that this is underfunded. Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, everybody is entitled at their trial, when it's a death sentence, to, for example, a psychiatric examination if there's any suggestion at all of mental disorders. If you're on trial for burglary, you don't get that. But in a death penalty case where anything that might move a single juror to vote for a sentence of less than death is fair game, you can put that on as evidence. And you need to independently investigate the DA's case. You can't just take the prosecutor's word for what happened. So there are requirements, constitutional requirements, about diligence and development of a case for your client. And then if you don't do that at the trial level, then you get to do it at a post-conviction review. And if the state does not let you do any of these things that you're supposed to do, or particularly critical ones, then federal courts will strike the death sentence down. It all takes more time and more money. In places where the process is sped up, there are more wrongful convictions, because these cases are precisely the kind of cases where there's intense pressure on the police and prosecutors to catch somebody. And that is exactly the situation that leads to confirmatory hypotheses and wrongful convictions.
So one way of reading this ruling is that it's basically conservative, that it argues for a more rational, more efficient system. But you're saying that even a conservative effort to make the death penalty prosecution more efficient is in and of itself makes it more obscene and destructive and wrong.
And horribly expensive, far more expensive than the money's now allotted to
because there are then these appeals based on.
Yeah.
So before moving to the broader implications of this for the movement to end the death penalty, what makes this progressive ruling, given that much of the alternative is framed in terms of a life without the possibility of parole? Indeed, a measure of progress on the death penalty issue in this country is based on public support growing considerably for alternatives to the death penalty, that alternative being life without the possibility of parole. That seems like a pretty meager measure of progress in my mind.
Well, it is, but I don't think we can seriously look at what life without the possibility of parole means until the death penalty is gone. Because death is different. You know, there have been people sentenced to LWOP, is what the slang for life without the possibility of parole is, who have later been released because something happened, something emerged that had not been discovered before. But if you're dead, you're dead. Everyone loses interest in your case, as they should. There are other cases, there are other people whose lives are in the balance. So the death penalty is so, you know, it's qualitatively different form of punishment than anything else.
But you're also saying that activists in this area do not use that as a measure in and of itself of justice or rationality of our system, of only avoiding the death penalty. It's part of a larger system of arbitrary and inhumane and racist confinement of people. Or am I putting words in your mouth there?
Well, that's all true. But on the ground, so to speak, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the death penalty in 1972. And the reason they did it, the reason they got even some conservative judges to go along with eliminating it, was because of how arbitrary and capricious it was. Justice Potter Stewart said it's akin to being struck by lightning. That's his term. In the case of Furman v. Georgia. And they said that if you execute less than 15% to 20% of the people who have been found eligible for death, then it approaches being random. Now, in Oregon now, the number is closer to 0.5% of people who are convicted and sentenced. It's ridiculously small. And Oregon is, in terms of the criteria used by Judge Carney from Orange County in Southern California, Oregon is even worse by those criteria.
In what sense?
In that the permissible way that the court in Furman said you can do a death sentence, and about 40 states promptly followed this right after the opinion, is to have two stages. One is a process of who's eligible for death. You've got to narrow it in theory to the worst of the worst. You want to have people who have committed multiple murders, people who committed torture murders, people who killed a police officer, who killed a witness. There are different criteria set up in different ways in different states, but the idea is that you've got to narrow the pool of all murderers in a rational way. Then when you
because it's already narrowed, a very small percentage of people who committed murder are prosecuted as capital cases.
Well,
but you're saying that's arbitrary who those that small number is.
Well, there are states that have successfully narrowed, but one of the problems with California that's even worse in Oregon is that there's no effective narrowing at all because of the way they've California's defined its special circumstances as their term for the narrowing factor that takes you out of the category of an ordinary murderer, is so broad that anybody, the prosecutors can charge anybody they want. Something like the statistics presented to Judge Carney were like, it's possible for 90% of murderers to be charged for a death sentence. But after that process of narrowing is complete, then the process of selecting who actually gets killed begins. And that's the stage when you leave behind all evidentiary rules where anybody can put in anything. The defense can put in any imaginable fact that would move somebody, that would cause a person to vote for a sentence of less than death. And the prosecution, in turn, can put on every bad thing you ever did or said. And it's a sort of a moral and normative decision, the way the law is set up. So Texas narrowed down, for example, to five categories of murder. They're not all that narrowing, but there is some effort at the first stage to narrow people down. In California, the narrowing process never really happens.
What about here in Oregon?
It's even worse. And here in Oregon,
it's up to prosecutors.
Well, an element of future dangerousness is a critical element in both the eligibility stage and the selection stage in Oregon. Now, that's such a fuzzy concept, future dangerousness. It may be okay to think about that when you're deciding whether or not to impose death. But to have it be a criteria, something the prosecution's got to prove beyond a reasonable doubt in order to make you go into a penalty phase is impossible. There's no way you can rationally predict who's going to be dangerous in the future.
And mental health professionals are notoriously unable to do that. I mean, the best predictor is only past behavior.
Well, the American Psychiatric Association submitted a brief to the U.S. Supreme Court showing that people who predict are wrong 95% of the time.
Yeah.
And the U.S. Supreme Court says that's fine, but we have to make these calls every day in bail hearings and parole hearings. You know, you have to guess, and that's okay at the later stage when you're deciding whether or not to actually kill somebody.
You know, one of the arguments, as I understand it, that Judge Carney introduced was that this is itself a kind of terrorizing of a person to have that hanging over them in an inconclusive way, the level of anxiety and horror in living through that. You work with a lot of death penalty cases. What's it like for people to live with that?
Some people are destroyed by it, who come apart. Other people are steeled by it, and become even better than they ever were before they were caught. It's very hard to tell. People are so unique and so individual. Overall, it's very corrosive. The fact that there have been 23 suicides on death row is an eloquent speech to how stressful it is. Most people there are not in good shape. The majority have serious mental problems. Some are able to kind of right themselves because of the regularity of their lives. But most people are stressed and just gradually unravel.
There is partly this ongoing legal process, right? And knowing you have claims to make on the state but can't fulfill those claims, that you have certain rights that are legally granted but without the means to exercise those rights in many cases, must be in and of itself kind of a source of torment. Not that the alternative is terrific either. I can see where just psychologically that could be a source of tremendous torment.
It is. I have two clients right now who are plagued by the fact that they've got very good issues, but one of them does not have a habeas lawyer. He only has an appeals lawyer, and there's none in sight because every year the number of convictions is greater than the number of people who are willing to accept post-conviction appointments. He may well never get a lawyer, and it is torturous when he's got a couple of solid meritorious claims that will never be heard. It's driving him nuts.
That's where there's that gap between rights and justice. That people can have formal legal rights, but without the means of exercising those rights.
And whether they get exercised is as random as who gets selected to die. So the real sentence is life without possibility of parole with a remote chance of death.
That's what the judge
offered
in a somewhat cynical tone. Does this whole situation register kind of a broader, I guess, ambivalence, or how prosecutors have leveraged ambivalence in this country about the death penalty? And of course, it's not like the country is sharing one big sentiment. There's a lot of opposition to it. But clearly, prosecutors are able to make use of this issue by prosecuting cases that will never lead to an actual execution. I mean, it seems like a kind of cynical enterprise.
Oh, it is, from top to bottom. And the prosecutors love it, primarily because it's helpful in forcing pleas of guilty to life without possibility of parole or life in prison. It's a handy weapon in that sense.
It's a big hammer hanging over everybody.
It is. The way in which the death penalty fell in 1972 is probably going to be the way that it falls now. And it is falling, make no mistake. There's atrocious crimes don't get the same sort of inflamed press coverage they used to. People don't care nearly as much as they did in the 80s when it was the dominant issue for all politicians everywhere. It's just lost a lot of traction. People are, I think, the continual revelations of people who are wrongfully convicted has shocked everyone into realizing this is government work.
And the recent reports, like on the tremendous abuse of prisoners at places like Rikers Island in New York, and the suffering of prisoners is as much a story now, much more a story now, it seems, than it was some time back.
It does. It has undercut cartoon pictures of them as inhuman monsters, which was popular in the 80s. So for a whole series of reasons, the support necessary to support an irrational, whimsical system is eroded badly. And therefore, the judge's opinion has not been excoriated by the usual suspects. It's gotten remarkably good press.
Okay, hopefully there'll be the death penalty within our lifetimes. Thanks, Mike. This is Jan Hawken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the recent U.S. District Court's ruling in California declaring the death penalty unconstitutional.
A gallows outside my cell. I've got 25 minutes to go. And the whole town's waiting just to hear me yell. I got 24 minutes to go.
Well, they gave me some beans for my last meal. I got 23 minutes to go. But nobody asked me how I feel. I got 22 minutes to go.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I assume all of you recognize that voice. It was Johnny Cash with a song called 25 Minutes to Go. This is the Old Mo Variety Hour. Now in our studio, Jan Hawken returns talking with Carla Castaneda and Perla Alvarez of Momentum Alliance about a summer camp they organize for underrepresented youth.
Well, welcome to KBOO, Carla Castaneda and Perla Alvarez. And we're interested in talking about your youth camp this summer. The Momentum Alliance put on a special camp for reproductive, around the theme of reproductive justice, which sounds very cool. So, Carla, why don't you start by just describing the camp and what happened?
Yeah, it was a two-week summer camp. There's around 25 youth that went, attended, and so it basically, the days were scheduled for youth to learn a little bit about each part of reproductive justice, and at the end of the camp, come up with their own definition or what they felt reproductive justice is.
And reproductive justice, that's a big concept and carries a lot of kind of political weight and freight. And so I can imagine for a lot of youth, as with adults, it's kind of hard to get their mind around something that big. How did you unpack it, so to speak, in terms of what all that includes?
Yeah, so we came up with our own reproductive justice definition, and I'll just read it to you. It means having self-determination and control individually and collectively over our own bodies, how we live, and who we love.
Okay, so that's a definition that would require maybe a different kind of society in a pretty broad way. It's not just a single campaign around a specific issue, but much broader. How did you come to that broader notion? And maybe you could talk about how you got there.
Yeah, so like Carla said, during the different days, we had different focuses. For example, we had trainings on what it means to be transgender, what it means to be an ally to transgender people. We also had days where we talked about abortion, days where we talked about what it means to be a woman, what it means to be a man, what it means to be LGBTQ. So we had this this idea or these days where young people got to see what the definition meant. And by the end of the camp, the young people left with an understanding of what reproductive justice is. And they left with this idea of becoming an ally and also loving their bodies and loving their decisions, knowing that they are the ones who decide what happens with their body, and knowing how to respect other people with the choices that they make.
Did this focus on controlling your own body and sex reproduction and a broader conception of having control over your own body, how did that line up with other political issues in the lives of youth, particularly coming out of communities of color, who might say, well, that's not our main issue. You know, our main issue is immigration, or our main issue is poverty, or the incarceration issues that, or police, that weigh very heavily on communities of color. How did you connect reproductive justice with these other issues that weigh so heavily on minority communities?
I think all those issues just connect without us making them connect, just because it's a really big issue that affects everything. And reproductive justice, before making choices for others or helping, trying to make choices for others, you have to know who you are and where you stand. And being in control of your body is really important to advocating for other things.
Were there some of these issues that were more difficult? Because as I understand it, youth in the camp both were involved in exploration of their own identity and how to tell stories about and represent their own experience, but also how to talk with other people in their own communities around issues that are fraught with a lot of emotion and tension and conflict. So how did you prepare youth for that? The hard part of it, because you can say politically and intellectually we know all these are connected, but showing those connections and arguing for that ground to stand on is much more difficult in practice.
Yeah, one of the things we did was a fishbowl activity where young people got to hear different stories from different people out there in the community. Stories about abortion, stories about abuse, stories about being genderqueer. And that opened up a space where young people felt comfortable to share their own stories, but also to talk to other people about issues that involve those topics. And we prepared them to go out and explore in the community what did other people think about those topics. And they had the opportunity to go out and interview strangers in the North Portland community. Carla, you want to talk a little bit more about the interviews?
Yeah, so we split the youth into teams, and each team got to make up their own questions. Some of them were about sex ed, abortion, gender identity, birth control, things like that. And they got to choose three questions out of all these terms that reproductive justice has. I think a lot of youth, including myself, made a lot of assumptions on how to ask those questions and our responses that we were going to get back.
What would be an example of an assumption you brought into that?
Well, my first, we were going to ask what people thought of abortions and if it should be legal or not. My assumption was that many people were going to be against it. But in fact, most of them were really open about talking about abortion and supporting abortion as well.
So the conservative, the assumption that people were conservative in certain issues wasn't borne out. But there also is a range of even legal protections around abortion that often make it legal under very narrow circumstances. So social movements can end up getting in this bind where you use these horrific stories to win your argument morally and politically, you know, telling a story of someone who's just suffered terribly and who's been raped or victim of incest, and that, and there's quite a high percentage of people who will grant the legal right to abortion under certain circumstances, but will not unless there's a dramatic story. How did you deal with that issue in terms of the kinds of stories that win the argument?
Well, Momentum Alliance is all about storytelling and sharing your own story in your own way. Like Perla said, we had a lot of fishbowl activities, and it wasn't just about when we heard abortion stories about women who had a dramatic experience, but also allies that supported women on having an abortion and how that was. So there was like a lot of different point of views that went along with storytelling in our fishbowl activities that helped the youth be open-minded.
Yeah, I think this issue of allies is maybe an important part of a project like this, because I think sometimes people can feel on the defensive or too exposed in a fishbowl exercise. But if you're encouraging people to take a point of view of someone else or be a supporter, that maybe opens a little more room for people to not feel so directly scrutinized. In closing, I know there was another activity that your group is going to be a part of around abortion rights, the bus project. Can you say a bit about that and in closing?
Yeah, we opened up an opportunity for young people to become more involved in the reproductive justice movement. And there is a van going around the country, and it is put on by the Coalition for Abortion Access. And the movement, or the van, is called All Above All Campaign, and it is building support for abortion funding. That's about all I can say about it right now, but if you want to know more about it, look up All Above All Campaign.
Okay, and maybe we'll have you back to hear more about that bus and whether we all want to get on the bus. Okay, or be here to greet it. Thanks so much for being with us today. This is Carla Castaneda and Perla Alvarez with Momentum Alliance talking about the Reproductive Justice Summer Camp. Summer, keep up the good work.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Joe Clement has been our engineer. Today's program will be podcast on the KBU website in the next day or two. You can either listen to the entire program or specific segments. You can also find links to more information about guests and topics, as well as past programs. If you want to learn more about the free store, you'll also find on our webpage an extended interview with Karen Carr, one of the store's founders. For more talk about the Portland Free Store, which will happen next at the Community Supported Everything Building this Saturday, July 26th at 1 to 3 p.m. The CSE building is at 1626 Northeast Alberta. Tune into this extended version of their conversation where Karen expands on the anti-capitalist politics the Free Store aims to practice and popularize. Next Monday, we'll be airing part two of Bill Resnick's interview with Gwen Sullivan, president of the Portland Association of Teachers, and Elizabeth Teal, an activist teacher on the teachers' union follow-up plans after winning a contract that put them in a position to build more engaging schools and curricula. This is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.